This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. Now to our special series, No Plan B, about our responses to climate change. People are doing a variety of things to try and help out, going vegan, recycling, driving less, and more. But we asked you what you wanted to talk about this week, and one topic in particular came up over and over.
Hello, my name is Nathan. I'm calling because one thing that I don't hear people talk about much in regards to climate change is that the human population, if it is what is affecting the climate, to possibly reduce population, because on a scale of one person to 7 billion people, there's a number in there at which the Earth can sustain in the ways that we pollute inherently. And if we can find that magic number of population, maybe that can ease ourselves also. But that I don't hear being talked about much.
Nathan, thank you for raising the topic, and we will talk about that with our guests this hour. Joining us here in studio to discuss it is Kathleen Mogelgaard, a senior fellow at the Population Institute and an adjunct professor at the University of Maryland. Professor Mogelgaard, welcome back to 1A.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
And joining us from Oakland is Kelsey Piper, a staff writer at Vox, where she writes for Future Perfect, a reporting project focused on ideas to improve the world. Kelsey, welcome.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
We've also gotten a lot of your questions and comments and thoughts and some of your stories about the decisions you've made about the structure of your own family as it relates to climate change. We'd love to know about your thought processes on this. Have you decided to have children, not to have children, to have fewer children? Are you still agonizing over it? Or what questions do you have around this whole issue? Email us 1A@WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. Professor Mogelgaard, let me start with you. Where do we stand right now with the world's population and the outlook for where it's going?
Right now, the world's population is about 7.7 billion people, and the population is growing. And in some places of the world, it's growing very rapidly. The demographers from the United Nations project that population by 2050 is likely to be somewhere between 9.4 billion and 10.1 billion people.
I'm sorry, 10 billion people by when?
By 2050.
By 2050, which is also one of the years that we have some key carbon, some key temperature targets, I believe, in terms of the temperatures that we have to keep the Earth below in order for us to stand a chance of survival.
That's right.
Kelsey, what impact does population have on climate change? Is there a clear consensus across the board of a causal or even correlated link between population and climate change, or are we just kind of guesstimating?
So certainly there's the obvious, which is that every person who lives on the world emits some carbon and consumes goods that are produced by emitting carbon, although the amount of carbon emitted depends tremendously on where those people are, with people in countries like the United States. Adding a person in the United States increases carbon emissions by much, much more than adding a person in the parts of the world that are actually growing, which are mostly poorer parts of the world. And there's pretty good numbers on the effects of carbon emissions from having additional people. But people have other effects on the world too, and those are harder to measure. Children, for example, are one of the biggest constituencies pushing to fight climate change. And maybe with fewer children, we'd have fewer dedicated advocates standing up for the future of the world, because it's the world they're invested in. And we need a new generation of clean energy technologies and solutions, and people are the ones who are going to power those too. So on that side, it's much harder to measure.
It's interesting you mentioned that, because we've gotten a number of comments to that very effect. Ian wrote on our Facebook page, "We have a beautiful 3-month-old son. I'm scared of what the planet he'll be left with will be like. I hope he's like Greta," meaning Greta Thunberg, the climate activist, "and hope against hope he doesn't have to be. This is the only planet we all have." Ian, congratulations on the 3-month-old, by the way. Renee wrote on our Facebook page, "The irony is that we especially need the children of these thoughtful, concerned, empathetic, loving people. Please fill the world with your children and you'll leave it a much, much better place." However, Joe wrote on our Facebook page, "Stop having children. We can't even sustain the planet with the people we have now." Professor Mogelgaard, what are we talking about? Are we talking about having no more children, having fewer children? Like, what's the target?
It's really difficult to pinpoint exactly what a target should be when it comes to population growth and its impacts on climate change. As Kelsey mentioned, the places in the world that are growing the fastest right now have very small carbon footprints. However, we do know that over time, with economic development and expanding consumption, you know, lifting people out of poverty in different places around the world, that the way our population grows in the future will have an effect on the way we use and consume and produce the resources, the limited resources on this planet. So it's really important that we think carefully about how that population will grow, what we can do to ensure that people have a high quality of life, and really critically, ensuring that people everywhere in the world have options and choices for how they want to, if and whether they want to become parents in the first place. Right now, there are far too many people around the world who don't have access to the information and the services that enable them to make those kinds of choices.
Yeah, Kelsey, can we clarify that just a bit in terms of the difference between families in more developed Western nations and families in poorer parts of the world, developing nations and so forth? I want us to be clear on what we're really talking about in terms of the differences between different kinds of families. Kevin wrote on our Facebook page, "I fully support liberals not having children, but it won't matter since more population growth comes from poor countries than the developed ones. They don't have the luxury to worry about their carbon footprint. They're just having more kids to increase the odds of survival." Kelsey, I'm not sure if that's true. That kind of makes human beings sound like rabbits who are just trying to have as many children as possible to carry on their bloodline. But what do we actually know about the differences between how families in different parts of the world have children?
So I think there are a couple complicated issues that your listeners are touching on there. So one consideration is, yes, population growth is being driven by population growth in poor countries. Not just most population growth, all population growth is being driven by population growth in poor countries. The birth rates are below replacement, meaning that people are having fewer kids than would be needed to sustain the same population size in every rich country from within the United States to Europe to East Asia. Those countries are mostly facing declining populations, and if they're not, it's because of immigration. It's not because of native birth rates. So without any climate strike, without any of those considerations, populations are already shrinking in the developed world. So that leaves me a little troubled, because it suggests that if your goal is stopping the world population from growing, you're largely trying to persuade women who want to have children in poor countries to have fewer children. And while I'm extremely supportive of giving women more options everywhere in the world, options for education, options for alternatives to homemaking if that's not what they want to do, reliable contraception so they don't become pregnant if they don't want to, the fact of the matter is that women in poor countries value different things than women in rich countries on average, and many of them want to have more than two children. And I think it's very deeply not our place, particularly not our place in order to fight back up against the problem that we created and they had nothing to do with, to say that they shouldn't do that. And I think it's in fact our duty to be supportive of those families, whatever form the people making them want to have, including if they want a big family.
Also worth noting that quite a few of you have made the same point that one of our listeners tweeted. They wrote, "By population control, what a lot of folks mean is fewer brown people. The connection between this type of rhetoric and eugenics is undeniable." Professor?
I want to push back a little bit against something that Kelsey just said, which is this idea that we would be telling women in the poor, in poor developing countries to have fewer children than they want. What research shows us is that there are hundreds of millions of women in the developing world who have an unmet need for family planning. What that means is that these are women who would like to avoid or delay pregnancy, but don't have meaningful access to the information and services like family planning services that would help them achieve their childbearing desires. Because we have this huge gap in meeting women's needs around the world, I think we should be focusing greater effort on closing that gap and meeting those needs and ensuring women around the world have rights and choices when it comes to their childbearing decisions. And if we were able to do that, we would see a slower population growth path, which would go a long way toward helping us achieve what we want in terms of sustainability and addressing the climate crisis.
With regards to this comment, Professor, from the listener about less brown people, is that accurate? I mean, are the parts of the world that we're talking about mostly populated by black and brown people, or is it more nuanced than that?
It's much more nuanced than that. As I was saying, there are women in developing countries who have this unmet need for family planning. They may want to have 3-4 children. They may want large families, but many of them are having larger families than they would like. And so by being able to help women in the developing world achieve their childbearing desires, we could come a long way toward slowing population growth globally.
Some of you have shared some pretty remarkable stories with us about the way you view your own family planning decisions. Susan emailed, "I am now 61 years old. At 17, I made a decision to only parent a child who was already on this planet. We didn't really talk about climate change as such back then, though we were aware of the negative effects on the planet of rising population rates across the globe. At 31, I had my tubes tied as further commitment and assurance. I thought, but the planet cannot. At 41, I adopted and have always been grateful for the choices I made." We are speaking to Kathleen Mogelgaard, a senior fellow at the Population Institute and adjunct professor at the University of Maryland, and Kelsey Piper, a staff writer at Vox. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A. Can we be a little bit clearer on what we mean about the carbon footprint of a person? Kelsey, I don't know if we have a more precise way of articulating this, but Kelly wrote on our Facebook page, "From birth to death, a human has an enormous carbon footprint. Then they die, are buried in a cemetery, and someone mows the grass around their grave." Kelsey, how do we quantify what our carbon footprint really is? It's kind of hard for me to think about what the right population should be without kind of knowing what the parameters are.
So I think an important point here is that at our current level of carbon emissions per person, there is no population that works. If we were to cut the population of the United States by half and cut our carbon emissions by half that way, we would still have far too many carbon emissions and a totally unsustainable amount of carbon emissions. The thing that the United States needs to do is to get to zero carbon emissions in order to keep the planet from warming unsustainably. We need to do that with a combination of carbon capture technologies that remove CO2 we've already emitted and with a total transition to clean sources of energy and ceasing to burn fuels that release carbon dioxide. We can't succeed if we are continuing to emit carbon at our current rate per person, even if we had a much, much smaller human population. That's not to say that population has no effect, but this isn't a problem you can solve on the population side.
That kind of gets to a point, Professor, that Linda made. Linda emailed, "I understand the concern about the world population for a number of reasons. In terms of resource exploitation and carbon emissions, the developed countries, mainly the U.S., are contributing to both of these crises despite relatively flat population growth. The main problem in these countries is consumption of energy and resources, more so than population." So, Professor, if that's the case, then are we kind of spinning our wheels talking about population? It sounds like there are much bigger fish to fry than whether we should tell families to bear children or not.
It's a really good point. I think when we're trying to think about ways to address the climate crisis, we need a lot of solutions on the table. We have many, many hundreds of fish to fry when it comes to addressing the climate crisis. As Kelsey mentioned, transitioning to clean energy is absolutely crucial. We need to think about ways of enhancing natural systems to better capture and store carbon. We need to see a pretty quick drawdown of carbon concentrations in the atmosphere. Population population is just one piece of the picture when we're thinking about long-term strategies for having a safe climate. And certainly, in my view, if we are able to slow population growth and be toward the lower end of population projections by 2050 and 2100, all of the other solutions that we need to take to address the climate crisis will be a little bit easier to achieve. But population growth in and of itself is not causing the climate crisis, but it is something that we need to consider as we think about the package of solutions that will get us to where we need to be.
Kelsey, I'm interested in some of the stories that you've heard from people in terms of what they have chosen to do in terms of their family planning choices. Let me just read two more that have come in. Stacy emailed, "My husband and I have two children, and although we may like to consider adding to our family, we have decided not to due to our concerns about the environment. We decided we would replace ourselves and not add any additional strain on the environment." And Chris emailed, "I am a single white woman of childbearing age. I was recently sterilized because I believe it is selfish to bring a child into this world when we cannot guarantee a sustainable and livable environment. I wish more people would think of others instead of themselves." Kelsey, what are you hearing in terms of the steps people have taken?
So I think one thing I hear over and over again is enormous frustration and despair at the failure of our government to tackle the climate crisis. And people feel like they care deeply about this. They've tried to make their voice heard. They've tried to call for the necessary reforms. They've heard scary things about what's coming in the future if those reforms don't happen. And that's received with silence. And I think that's a lot of what's driving the interest in not having children, is the sense that there's nothing that can be done on a political level, nothing that can be done on a societal level, because people feel like they've tried those and gone unheard. But in that sense, not having children is more a symptom than a solution. It's something that's coming from the desire to fix the environment, but it's not going to fix the environment. As we discussed, whatever the human population, we're going to have to transition to clean energy, and we're going to have to transition to a carbon neutral economy. And it doesn't solve that problem. And so I do worry that people are making what can in some cases be an enormous personal sacrifice, not because it will solve the problem, which it can't do, but just because they feel like nothing they're doing is being heard and nothing they're doing matters. And that's just a tragic failure of our leadership that should be addressed at that level.
Kind of to the point of the leadership, Dogwood Slim tweeted, "I hate this entire discussion because all it does is place the lion's share of fixing climate change on individuals when it was created by industry. Moreover, most of these comments on population control are creating platforms for eugenicists." I'm interested in the industry part of Dogwood Slim's comment. Let's get to that when we continue with Kathleen Mogulgaard of the Population Institute and Vox staff writer Kelsey Piper. Also want to get to some of the comments that some of you have made, just basically asking whether this is the kind of world in which you want to bring children. How much of this conversation is about the environment? How much of it is environmental? And how much of it is emotional? We'll get to that in a minute. Stay close. Back now to our conversation with Kathleen Mogulgaard and Kelsey Piper. Glad to get some more of your questions and stories in. Maida from Denver left us a message explaining why she has decided not to have kids.
For me, I am one of six kids. I'm the oldest. And generally for me with climate change, I chose to study it in college. And today, I pretty much think that I should not have kids, especially if the world is already coming to an end and none of our politicians are looking to change those.
Maida, thank you for sharing your story with us. I'd like to get back, Professor, to this comment from Dogwood Slim, who tweeted, "I hate this entire discussion because all it does is place the lion's share of fixing climate change on individuals when it was created by industry. Moreover, most of these comments on population control are creating platforms for eugenicists." I know we've already discussed the eugenics and the racial aspect of this, but what about the industry piece of this? I mean, people do have to deal with this because people who vote, who are citizens, who drive government, who are responsible for, you know, deliberative democracies, have to make decisions that lawmakers would follow. But I also see his point. Or see Dogwood Slim's point.
It's a really important point. And, you know, I teach a class at the University of Maryland called Hungry, Hot, and Crowded, Global Challenges of the 21st Century. And as part of this class, students are learning about global population growth, climate change, global hunger, and how all of these issues are connected. One of the assignments that students have in the class is to select an individual action that they can take about their lifestyle and to implement that individual action for 2 weeks. So they'll do things like not drive their car for 2 weeks, or they will eat a vegan diet for 2 weeks to see what that's like. And to, they'll try to make calculations about how, if more people took that action, would it make a difference for how we're trying to address these challenges? And it gets students thinking about what is this balance that's appropriate between the individual choices that I make about my lifestyle and the broader systems changes that we need that will be driven by policy and driven by economic changes in the way we produce and consume energy and the way our transportation systems and other major systems that are responsible for greenhouse gas emissions in the atmosphere. And it's interesting for students to have that reflection on that balance between individual choices and the larger systemic change that's needed to get us where we need to go when it comes to addressing the climate crisis. I think a lot of students conclude that there are things that we can do in our individual lives that will reduce our carbon footprints, but it's also extremely important for some of those individual choices to be voting and supporting the policies that we need for broader systemic change that are really going to be able to have the impact at scale that we need to see.
We got a voicemail from Nate in Ohio who called and told us what he's grappling with. Here's what Nate left in our inbox.
Ever since I was a teenager, I've always thought that I would love to have kids. I thought that the greatest thing I could do in my life is to raise children and bring them into a world that I have left better for them than when I got here. Through years in my 20s as a climate change activist and still fighting for climate change legislation, I don't know. I don't know whether bringing kids into this world is the right decision. I'm still debating that to this day, but I firmly hope that we can win this fight and that I can bring children into a world that is sustainable and that will be worthwhile for them to live in. But I still don't know.
Yeah, Nate, I appreciate you sharing your thoughts with us. Thank you very much. And Nate's certainly not the only person, Kelsey, that we've heard this kind of thought process from. Some folks have really agonized over this and made some big decisions as it relates to having families or not. Dan tweeted, I'm 33 and I recently broke up with my girlfriend of 3 years because she wanted kids and I told her I was terrified of bringing a child into the world to suffer a terrible existence that is all but assured at this point. Kelsey, there's a certain nihilism, or maybe fatalism is the better word, that some folks are expressing, that they're kind of convinced that we're screwed. And why would you want to bring a child into a world that you are convinced is doomed to both sink and burn?
Yeah, I think that's a huge part of what's driving the reluctance to have children. Not so much a strategic, oh, if I don't have a child, it will reduce carbon emissions by this much, but just a fear of where we're going. I do want to say that I think that the world will be worth living in 2050, and I think the world will be worth living in 2100. For most of human history, we've been a lot poorer than we are now. We've had much lower consumption than we are now, and people have lived good lives, happy, meaningful lives. And you know, people live in places that are much hotter than any of the United States is going to get, even under climate change, and they live good lives and happy lives. And so I do want to say to people at least that one thing, which is that there will be good lives in 2050 and there will be good lives in 2100. And if you're longing to have children and bring children into the world, then do that and fight for the world. You can absolutely do both of those.
Professor, I want to get your sense of this. I hear where Kelsey's coming from. I mean, I would like to believe that we're not on the path to living in Mad Max Fury Road, being chased by a Morton Joe trying to get gasoline. Like, I'm hoping that that's not what the world is going to look like. But I also understand the cultural fight over this, and it gets really personal. Mary emailed, thanks so much for having this valuable discussion. I have a 10-year-old and a 4-month-old. Congratulations. I work in an international development organization that addresses the effects of climate change on farmers in developing countries. Yet, I want a third child. I feel the piercing gaze of my progressive friends and colleagues for uttering this. Is this whole debate more about the cultural tribes we're starting to form? I don't feel I hear this discussion happening on the right. Professor?
Oh, that's a really tough issue to tackle. I think our decisions about childbearing and the personal yearning that we feel to become parents and to nurture is very real. So I understand that listener's viewpoint 100%. It's interesting that she works in international development and she can see some of the challenges that we're facing around the globe.
People are giving her grief for wanting to have a child.
Well, I think that's an unfortunate development. I know that there are often discussions around, you know, these issues that are hard to talk about when it comes to people's individual consumption choices about whether you're vegan or not, or whether you drive a hybrid or not. And I think that is also bleeding into this realm of whether you decide to have children, whether you decide to have a large family. I would love to see a world, and I think this is something that we could all agree on, where women and families have the agency to achieve their childbearing desires. And that includes the support and acceptance of people who really would prefer not to become parents. There, especially in the United States and other countries around the world, I think that there are strong social norms that push people toward parenthood, whether they want to be parents or not. It's difficult in many places to make the decision to be child-free and to feel that you have the support of your family and friends. And I believe that if we could get to a place where everyone really did have rights and choices around childbearing, we'd see a lot more families that had no children, which could create more room for those families that want to have one, two, three, or larger families.
And that ties into a lot of other international development imperatives like education for girls and, you know, access to feminine hygiene products and all kinds of other things that are so tied into this. We also got a call from an expectant mother who I think is worth playing here. Here's what Katie left in our inbox.
My name is Katie, and I'm calling from Washington, D.C. My husband and I are expecting our first child in about 2 weeks, and we really struggled with the question of if we should bring a child into a world experiencing a dire climate crisis. We ultimately decided that having a child was a profound act of hope in the face of despair over the climate. But knowing that we have to do something and that we're responsible for the well-being of our child and for the world he or she will inhabit, we've become more intentional about reducing our own carbon footprint and that of our child before he or she is born. So we've been biking, walking, or taking public transit, reusing more items, not buying so much new baby stuff because there's a lot of that, reducing our meat consumption, switching over to clean energy sources, and also advocating for policies that reduce the effects of climate change.
Well, Katie, thank you for sharing your story with us. All the best to you for a safe pregnancy and a happy, healthy newborn. Trajan, or Trehan, emailed, I think yelling stop having kids is an easy way to excuse yourself doing other things to reduce your carbon footprint. It's easy to give up a way of life you don't already have, a kid if you don't already have one, compared to giving up a way of life that you are entrenched in. Not many people are clambering to give up their trucks or SUVs and move closer to their workplace so they can walk or ride a bike. Until our society can make difficult decisions about how they already live, we won't see much change on our emissions. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A. Let's talk about some options going forward. Samantha in Chicago left us a note about what she sees as her options for starting a family.
It has been extremely upsetting to think about having a biological child. And in a lot of ways, at this point, with the way things are going, I feel strongly that to become a parent, adoption is probably the only option. I can't imagine having to tell an 18 or 19-year-old child in the 2020s or 2030s, you know, I'm so sorry that we tried but failed, and now you have to put up with, you know, what's left here. So in a way, as a younger, you know, teenager, I thought I would love to be a biological parent, but at this point, adoption's the only option for me. And I'm so sad that that's the reality.
Yeah, Samantha, I really appreciate you being willing to share that. Thank you very much. Kelsey, what about that? Adoption as an option, or does that still create the same amount of consumption in the long run?
So obviously adoption is a great option, and everybody who pursues it is doing a great thing. It's not an option for everybody for lots of reasons. One is that there's not actually babies in need of adoption in the United States today. There's older children, often children with disabilities and children with trauma. And if you can be a good, loving parent to those people, you should absolutely adopt them. I do worry about people who want a baby adopting older kids that they're not prepared for and don't have the skills to effectively parent or do right by those kids. So I don't think it's a perfect substitute, and you can't look at it as that. But that doesn't mean that adoption isn't a great thing for people who want to adopt. Then there's international adoptions. You mentioned the concern that if you adopt internationally, you're raising a child with a lot more carbon emissions than in their first country. I would actually say that that concern is secondary to concerns that some of those children are sourced unethically, with their birth parents being told falsely that this is temporary or that this is mandatory. Or kids who are not orphaned being said that they're orphans. There's ways to do international adoption that are a great thing and work for everybody, but it's certainly a challenging area, and it's not going to be right for everyone.
Molly emailed, "I do not plan to have any biological kids of my own, but I do plan to adopt. This seems like the best option for me to both limit emissions and to pass on my privilege as a white person who has been minimally impacted by climate change. To that end, I think our decisions on how to act must be more centered on climate justice than just based on fear." Professor Mogulgaard, that's a really interesting point, this idea of climate justice, climate equity, population, climate change, and just the disparate ways that people around the world are affected by climate change and are set upon to do something about it. What do you think of Molly's approach?
The climate justice issue is huge when we're thinking about addressing the climate crisis globally. We know that the parts of the world that have the fastest growing populations are the parts of the world that have been least responsible for the emissions that are causing the climate change impacts. I've spent some time working in Africa, where large parts of the population are dependent on rain-fed agriculture, for example. And to have the kinds of droughts, floods, and temperature shifts that are impacting the agricultural sector is making life much more difficult there. And that is a cruel irony, because those are parts of the world that have not contributed to the climate crisis in any kind of significant way. So I think your listener there is making a really important point that if we are going to tackle the climate crisis as a global community, we need to think about ways that we can help the most vulnerable countries adapt to the kinds of impacts that they are experiencing that are making it more difficult for them to be lifted out of poverty. And we need to think really critically about how we can support parts of the world to have more sustainable energy sources, and so that economic development can proceed in those places without further damaging the climate.
Kelsey, before we go, based on your reporting, what are some of the big things, or maybe the one or two big things, that you would encourage families to think about as they're making this decision about family planning and the climate?
So I think that every family should have the number of kids that they want. And whether those are biological kids or adoptive kids or a non-traditional family arrangement, I want a big family. So I and three other adults are raising a large family as the four of us, which is one way to do it. You know, you need to figure out what works for you and then dedicate your energies and effort to making the world better for your children. But if you don't want children, don't have them. And if you do want children, I think you should figure out a way to have them and figure out how to do right by them. I don't think it's a good idea to try and solve our climate problems by asking people to make enormous sacrifices that can't even solve the problem.
And Professor, before we go?
The thought that I would like to close with is that an investment in women and girls around the world is an investment in our future. Helping people to achieve their childbearing desires, particularly in places where there's been a historic lack of access to information and services around reproductive health and family planning, is a really valuable investment for women and for the planet.
Kathleen Mogulgaard, a senior fellow at the Population Institute and an adjunct professor at the University of Maryland, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
And Kelsey Piper, a staff writer for Future Perfect at Vox. Kelsey, thank you.
Thanks so much.
This conversation was produced by Jonquilin Hill. To learn more about our team, visit the1a.org/staff. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.